Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 126, Meditation, Death, and Dying.
Now, the reason that in Buddhist meditative psychology, the empty mind meditation is not considered the most important one, or that is to say, shamatha, what they call peaceful, staying still, stillness, silence of thought flows. This one is not the ultimate one. The reason of that is precisely that it does not unravel the complex fortification of the closed being, the conceptual cage of the ignorant person cannot simply just be eliminated by being ignored. It has to be disassembled carefully and cautiously. And therefore, the vipassana one is the more important one. Although, of course, the vipassana one, to reach its goal, must deploy the one-pointed concentration that it can be cultivated in the shamatha one. The danger of the shamatha one, the just emptying your mind and disassociating yourself from all thought flow, which can be achieved with the effort, the reason that the danger of that is that when one floats into a kind of space, one will assume that one has reached the sort of ultimate nature of reality, and that this is what reality ultimately is. And even the expression emptiness and the fact that it constantly takes space as its analogy, makes one, can lead one to be disillusioned in that way, or rather deceived in that way, where then one goes into one of those spacious states and thinks one is at the absolute. But actually, it's just a relational state, according to Buddha's own teaching and experience. For example, from the very earliest time of Buddhism, even when he was allowing people to think on purpose that nirvana was something out of this world, let's say, wasn't pushing non-duality, even in that beginning dealing with the male chauvinist Brahmins, he carefully said, well, when you go up above the divine planes of the Brahma-bodied gods, the four immeasurable pure states, or Brahma pure abodes, the Brahma-viharas, the four dhyanas, the four contemplative realms of immeasurable love, immeasurable compassion, immeasurable joy, and immeasurable equanimity. If you become so adept and so concentrated that you go even beyond those, the first thing you come to is a realm, but not, you can't use realm anymore. We call it a medium because there's no volume. It's called the medium of infinite space because there's no body, no mass. Medium of infinite space. And then your mind sort of seems to fill up, fill that up, and you move to a more subtle plane called the medium of infinite consciousness. And these mediums mean that you disappear into these states. You're not like a body floating in space. You're not like a mind being sort of peering around in the realm of infinite mind. You just have lost your personality, your infinite mind. You are infinite mind. You feel your infinite mind. And then that becomes a little bit also tiresome for you to be this big infinite mind with nothing much to do. So you go into absolute nothingness. You come to a threshold, and it seems as if you will no longer, you will be extinguished there. You will be extinct. And you feel that as a relief, actually, in that moment, because it's a yet more subtle state. You don't bother with philosophical, rational niceties about how nothing is nothing, so it can't be a medium. You just go into it. You extinguish your awareness, like falling asleep, actually. And then even that, somehow you're so concentrated by that time, you're so stable and steady, that you go from there into a state said to be beyond cognition or non-cognition, or you could simply beyond consciousness and unconsciousness, you can say. Naiva samnya, naiva asamnya, ayatana, the medium of that. So you're somehow conscious of being unconscious and unconscious of being conscious. It's in the realm of indescribable, you know, paradoxical, but it's considered the most subtle possible egocentric state. Although it feels to the person as if they have incorporated the vastness of infinite space, infinite consciousness, and even nothingness, and they're embracing all of that. And yet, it's still just them, even though they don't say I there at all. So Buddha achieved these states, he said, and actually in his biography, although we can't necessarily rely on that, the validity of that, but in his biography he was just said, acclaimed by teachers, yogi teachers and others, to have attained these states. And that fourth one is very similar to what in Hinduism they call nirvikalpa samadhi, non-conceptual concentration, or sometimes turiya, the fourth state. But Buddha clearly said these are not nirvana. He said nirvana is something, but it's not these. Nirvana is reality, but not these. Nirvana is just as much the reality of running around or being in hell as being in one of those super quiet states. He insisted. But he didn't emphasize. He just left it out there for those who might have felt overwhelmed to take full responsibility for their state of delusion and might feel there's some place they can take their personality, their conflicted, ignorance-driven personality, closed personality, separated personality. There's some place they can take that, that will be the final place, the final freedom of that personality. He knew they needed to feel that way. But then he left that hint. Those kind of states are not nirvana. Neither are all the many heavenly states that he described, actually, also. Now, this is not merely just, I'm not just professoring here. This is conceptual and intellectual to understand, but it is something also that influences one's life and one's meditation. Why? Even you shut your mind into complete quiescence by becoming an adept at quiescence, shamatha. Unconsciously or subliminally, you still have a sense of where you are. You still are within a context, subliminally. For example, our culture, the modern culture, is within a context that if you reduce everything down completely, you reach the state of nothingness. That is to say, you become extinct upon death. That is the framework within which we live, and it's sort of reinforced by the fact that at night, when we fall asleep, we go unconscious and actually find it restful. We assume it's just from being unconscious that the rest comes without thinking necessarily about it. We look out in the sky at night and we see some stars out there, and depending on what we know about astronomy, we realize the light is like millions of years old, or light years, you know, because they're light years away and all this kind of thing. And really there's just a dark space out there, and above our fragile atmosphere then there nothing can live. So it's kind of a death space, a death zone of nothingness. We have the common sense that inside the atoms that constitute our substantial world, habitual substantial world, there's like a nothingness, an empty space. And so that context makes us feel that in some ultimate sense, we, our life, its purpose is sort of meaningless. It's not there. It's inexplicably an accident, random mutation, pure accident. And the scientists act like that's a discovered fact even. And they assure us about that and look down on us if we try to say something, well, God has a purpose, or evolution has a purpose, or I have a purpose, or something. They're like, oh yeah, great, okay, good. I hope that gets you through to the cemetery of heavenly rest, the lawn of eternal sleep, or whatever it's called. So that's one kind of context. Then in the older era, and still some people here in the West, the 55 million people who have moved in the last 40 years from mainstream religious denominations into born-again evangelical ones, they are going back into that older one where the context is this wonderful, benevolent God. So you die, you'll be taken care, because then he sent Jesus, so he'll take care of you, or you're faithful to Allah and he'll take care of you, or Yahweh, he'll take care of you. So there's a context that there's this God force. But then there's sort of some very uneasy aspects of that, because there's all this threat from the scriptures of the different traditions that you're going to go to hell if you do the wrong thing. And that so then you get the subliminally that God is not that nice. Like, it's like, as a he, right? And then he's like mean. He's going to send a lot of people he created. He's then going to send them off to roast. That's really, and it might be me if I, like, I don't know, have too much fun or something. And that really makes you uneasy, which, like Calvin and people like that, really belabored to indicate that some of you were created to be saved and some not, ahead of time, no matter what you do. But that's a context. And then if you a little bit touch the mystics, which you're not allowed that much to do in the Western religious traditions, they say, oh, it's just infinite love, you know. So then you're all right when you die, you know. You'll be all right no matter what. They're just a bluff, the business of hell, you know. Mystics kind of see like that. So that's another kind of context. And this is really, really important. That's why I said last night, Medicine Buddha, when you receive the teaching of Medicine Buddha, if we were lucky enough to have Medicine Buddha somewhere, or if we were back there in India, or whenever he manifests, in the field of such a being, then one sees everything as positive. And one feels at ease about death. One feels at ease about surrendering to the luminosity, about letting go of one's boundary, about opening one's you know, emotional armoring, Wilhelm Reich would have called it, or one's rigid sense of I'm fending off the universe, which I'm scared of, because it might do me in. Then, really positive context makes one feel it's okay to let go, you know, float downstream. It's all okay. So this question of examining one's context is really, really meditatively important. And it takes a conscious effort to look at whatever contexts, cosmic contexts, are on offer, and to sort of see what is the evidence for these different contexts, and therefore, what is practical to try to cultivate the awareness of, to change what. Oh, this is a very big important point, the difference of Buddhist psychology and Western psychology, modern, you know, contemporary psychology. And that is, you know, from Freud on, people thought that the unconscious is automatically and inevitably unconscious. And, you know, you just try to balance, it's you try to get any kinks out of it, any bottlenecks in there, any traumatic cramps and so forth that will make you consciously unfunctional. But in principle, it will remain unconscious. And that's why dreams, you shouldn't try to be a lucid dreamer, because the dreams are where messages can come to you from the unconscious if you just let them be spontaneous. But that's within a contemporary worldview, materialist worldview, where you're only concerned with your mental ease and unease in this life. For the Buddhist, that's not good enough. For the Buddhist, although the unenlightened person has a hugely powerful unconscious, and they're very much driven by emotional impulses and deep conceptual structures that they're not conscious of, that's unacceptable. The purpose and the opportunity of the human lifetime is to become conscious of that unconscious. And that is what all the meditation and all the study and all the contemplation, all the teachings are all about. Methods how to drill down into that unconscious and make it conscious and change the instinctual impulses that drive one to be more consciously directable, cultivate the positive drives, because the human being has many positive, loving, compassionate, sensitive drives. Or that's how we got to be human beings. And because the point is, when you die, your whole mind goes with you in a subtle form, just like, you know, the qualities, you know, if you look like your parents or your grandparents, some aspects of your physiognomy, you know, your earlobe resembles your grandmother, or your nostril looks like your father, or whatever it might be, your chin is like your uncle or something, you know, your color hair, you know, eye color. That's a very amazing process where their physical quality or property gets boiled down into a genetic code in a molecule, some sort of four-letter code thing, the original bunch of four-letter words going down and down in some spiral, marvelous thing recently discovered. And then it gives signals to your proteins that you get in the womb and then you get after you get born. And then you build up and you have the same shape. That's amazing. That's like an inconceivable, magical thing if you meditate on it. So similarly, your mind's more coarse properties, you know, your major habits of your mind, they kind of boil down into something called your gotra, your like a gene, your spiritual gene, your Buddha gotra, your Bodhisattva gotra, your whatever kind of gotra it is. And that gotra is like it encodes your behavioral patterns, and your, which include your thought patterns, not just physical behavior and verbal behavior, but also thought behavior. And then you build up to, you, then you probably gravitate toward parents whose physical genes relate to having behaved in certain ways, so that the three genes, there's some sort of connection there in some micro level. And then also you start manifesting some of your previous life's habits in the next life. And the more free of being unconsciously driven you are at the death-rebirth transition, death between rebirth transition, then the more consciously you can choose your parents, your culture, your race, your species, your society, and finally your neighborhood. That's one of my favorite, that's one of my books that I probably won't write in this life. How to be reborn in Los Angeles, or on the East Side, or you know, something like that. Because, you know, there's this time in the Book of the Dead, where, Book of Natural Liberation, where the dreamlike embodiment of the soul being, or the spiritual gene-bearing being, cruises around and sees lots of couples getting it on in the human plane, and then falls in love with one of them and sort of wants to get into the action. It's like an Oedipal or Electra event prior to conception. I think it's quite marvelous. Thousands of years before Freud and has discovered the Oedipal thing. Marvelous thing. Anyway, so what I thought today, the main theme today to meditate on, which in a way we've been doing, starting with the Heart Sutra and then working backward, and I hope you learned the no-no's meditation. That's a really important one. But the main theme is where the path begins in the Indian and Tibetan way of organizing the path to enlightenment. And the first step in the path, actually death, and meditation on death is the second step. The very first step before doing the death meditation is what's called meditating on the precious jewel of a human embodiment endowed with liberty and opportunity, which is yourself, which you have. If you're listening to that teaching and understanding any language, Sanskrit or Tibetan or English or whatever it may be, that's considered the place to start. Because under unrealistic worldviews, people have the idea that sort of being human is just come, well, in the modern one, it's an accident, right? Meaningless accident. And if it's, you know, if you're healthy and if you have good circumstances and you're lucky enough, and you're lucky, then you can be a semi-pleasurable experience until you reach a certain age, as long as you stay reasonably well and free of accidents. But, and then it's over and it had no ultimate meaning. It's just like a random event in the universe. And then in theistic traditions, it's made by God. In the image of God, there's a puzzling thing, they say, because, of course, God is imagined as some kind of superhuman. And the purpose is to, I guess, to become like God. In the West, they get a little nervous about being too much like God. You know, then they sort of execute mystics who act like I am God, like occasionally they do. But sort of be like God, meaning loving, kind, maybe wise, although they don't emphasize wisdom, faithful. And so there is a bit of a purpose. And then one wants to get to heaven, you know. But in the Buddhist thing, it's a kind of a midway between the two in a funny way. Nobody created it. There's no such person to be blamed or praised for the whole shebang in Buddha's view. And Buddha got that view according to the scriptures, the Pali scriptures actually, as well as Mahayana. He got that view by meeting God. Do you know that sutra, Kevada Sutta, in Pali? Well, it wasn't Buddha in that one. There's another one where he meets in one of the Jataka tales. But in that one, a monk, a seeking monk meets, who's not a Buddhist, but he's a yogi, a samana, shramana, and he meets Brahma. And he comes up to Brahma and he says, okay, great Brahma, you know, he goes in subtle body, you know, meditatively to the Brahma heaven. And he says, I've heard you created the world. I'm a yogi who wants to understand it fully. Please tell me how you did it. What was there before earth, water, wind, fire, space, and consciousness? And then Brahma's answer to him is, basically, do you have an appointment? And he says, you know who I am, I'm great Brahma, and this and that. And he goes on, he recites it two or three times. And the yogi keeps saying, well, I know you are. I'm not saying you're not, but I didn't ask you that. I just want to know how it works and how you did it and how, what's happening. So then Brahma won't answer, so then he leaves. He withdraws from that heavenly plane. But as he's leaving, it's like a Wizard of Oz kind of story. Brahma comes out himself and meets him in some intermediary space and says, wait a minute, wait. And then first he's a little nervous. He thinks Brahma's going to scold him or punish him or something. Then Brahma says, no. You're a real seeker and a yogi, and I have to answer you. It would be very wrong of me to brush you off. The thing is, what happened is, when this particular material world arose from like a big arisal, big bang, but it's not a bang, it's kind of a more slow thing in the Indian cosmology. He says, when it arose, I was the first person here, and there was nobody else around, and I kind of wondered, like, where is everybody? Like, where am I? What am I doing here? Sort of thing. And as I was wondering that, all these other godlings that you saw there in my throne room, you know, in my heaven, they appeared, and when they saw me, they said, Dada! And first I said, I'm not your Dada. Like, give me a break. What's happening? And then they looked so threatened and freaked out. I said, okay, I'm your Dada. Everything is fine. It's all under control. Like Alexander Haig in the White House, you know. It's all under control. And ever since, are you okay? Do you need, who's having a cough there? Can we get you some water or something? You okay? Okay. And then the Brahma said, so I have to tell you, admit that to you, you know, because you're a real seeker and you're asking the wrong person. The person who understands how evolution works is the Buddha down there, who's on India right now. So you should go and ask him. And he will explain it to you, whatever best way for you to understand it. And then there's two more things I want you to do. First, ask him to explain it to me. And because Buddha, even in Pali Sutras, Buddha goes to the different heavens, actually. It's not like Pali is all very humanoid. He goes to those heavens and he teaches those gods. He teaches his mother in one of them, who's in Indra's heaven and so on. And he teaches other ones too and helps them because they get very upset, the gods. Because when they've been God for a billion years type thing and then they fall down, it's very, everything is terrible. They don't want to really be in some lower plane, you know. And he consoles them and teaches them what to do and tries to get them to think about it when they're in their party land, you know, heaven, bliss land. So pleasure land, he tries to get them to think about the longer term and to use their tremendous divine intelligence to study the Dharma. And apparently many of them do, actually, they say. So anyway, and that's the first thing. And then the second thing is ask Buddha to tell the human beings when horrible things happen to them, it isn't my fault because I'm not omnipotent, I didn't create evil, you know, which is the Buddhist answer to the theodicy problem of the monotheist. So there's actual in the thing, you know. So the context that, but then so maybe it's sad. Some of the Indians in Buddha's time and subsequently were sad that Buddha, who supposedly became enlightened by discovering the nature of reality, he said, no, there, you know, Vishnu, Shiva, and they didn't create everything, and I didn't create everything. Nobody created everything. We're all constantly co-creating it through a process of causation, which he called karma. Which really means evolution, actually, evolutionary causation. It's a constant evolution, but one that can go up or down, you know. And that's the causal process, you know. And his karma theory, I consider it a biological theory of how life is shaped and formed, which includes mind as a force in nature instead of just pretending it's all some atoms and molecules and genes, you know. That's part of it, but there's also the minds of beings, you know. And it's more radical than Darwin. Darwin just says, you know, and the creationists are freaked about Darwin because your Texas creationist doesn't want to have genes like a chimpanzee, you know, which would also mean like a black person or a Mexican, you know. They want to go with Donald Trump and build a big wall. They don't want to be female. They don't want to, whatever it is. They want to be like a white god, you know, like they have in those things in San Diego, that famous thing of the fundamentalists. So, but Buddha, people who listened to Buddha and all the people in India subsequently, they didn't mind. Not only did they don't mind having chimpanzee genes, they don't mind having been a chimpanzee, personally. And again, danger of being a chimpanzee if they act too chimp-like. You know, or gravitate toward a chimp. And like, we had one lama who lived with us in Amherst who was really upset by Miss Piggy. He was so upset. He liked Miss Piggy too, but he was very upset. He said, what would happen to a young person, child, who watched a lot of Miss Piggy and fell in love with her and then died in an auto accident or some disease or something? And then was like, in the between state, he would head toward the pig world because he's so much like Miss Piggy. And we said, remember, said, don't be so upset. It's just that it's an animal fairy tale. The Buddhist former life stories, the Buddha was a pig and Buddha was a dog. And they said, yeah, but they weren't watching him on television 20 hours a day, he said, and getting imprinted on the beauty of Miss Piggy. So he was not relenting on that. He was very worried about interfering with the karma of some poor young person. Because we will make a choice in the between state, according to them, how we get reborn, depending on what our aptitudes and what our inclinations are, and how we have cultivated. So my point is, and to have gotten to be human, we were immensely ethical as other kinds of animals. That is considered like a naturalistic, you know, natural science result. It's a theory, Buddha's theory about evolution. We evolved into the human form because when we were tigers, tigress, right? And there was a herd of wildebeest running along, and there was one pregnant wildebeest going there. And we somehow subliminally, without language and without having, you know, read WebMD or anything, we identified with having been pregnant with cubs ourselves, and we let her go. And we jumped on some awful, stringy old guy who would be like a rough chew. But, you know, we just only chew up one of them, not two of them. And, you know, your materialist bio-grammarians say that the tigress does that in order to have another one to eat later, which is so silly, projecting aggressive predatoriness into the thing. It's just a subliminal thing because the animal can't stop and think to identify with the other animal because they don't have but by that kind of little self-restraint, that's ethical. It's considering the embryo of the wildebeest, the little baby wildebeest in the womb, and the mother wildebeest. It's some kind of subliminal identification with that thing. And from that animal thing, built up over a million lifetimes of different kinds of animals, one comes to be this weird creature that we are. It's not obvious that this is a good life form. Like, we walk on two legs and our back hurts. You know, we can't run on four. We don't have a tail to hold onto a branch to get out of the way of a predator. We have our teeth suck. They're terrible. We have no fangs. We can't spit poison. It's not obvious, like, really good way of a mighty hunter that we're going to become mighty hunters once we invent A-bombs or, like, Remington rifles or whatever, Archie Bunker. We have a Glock pistol. That's like a whole complex sort of feedback loops. A bunch of things are going there. So the Buddha's view is, although there's no ultimate human nature or no ultimate thing, any human being can be a serial murderer, mass killer, like a Mao or something, you know, mass murderer person, Stalin, Mao, Hitler or something. And any human being can be a saint. And we are this very, very flexible, because of the complexity of our past, our identification process, our critical intellect, our self-shaping process. And so we are a being that, and also we're not too comfortable, like in a heaven plane, like those gods are. we are angels and gods. We are in this sort of on the edge between the quite a miserable, difficult, helpless state and some sort of too much pleasure, relaxed state. And we're sort of right there, vulnerable, open, completely able to change ourselves one way or another. And that is the precious human life endowed with liberty and opportunity. The liberty comes from not being born in hell or animal or in the wrong kind of God realm or something. And the opportunity comes from being in a place where there have been enlightened beings who have taught us. There have been great meditators like Dale come to teach us to turn inside and find out what's going on in there. And this is great. This is not everybody has that. It's very, very rare. You were saying last night rightly that how many people are sitting thinking about this kind of thing that we're thinking about last night on this planet. They're just rushing from pillar to post. A lot of them, most of them, like me. So the precious human life, that's why it's a realistic worldview, acceptance of causality, realizing that the idea of an uncaused cause or a first cause or something coming from nothing is an asinine idea and completely irrational and unexemplified. Nowhere in nature can it possibly happen. The rule of common sense is continuity in all. And similarly, an end into nothing will also not happen. It all goes on forever. They kind of act like, oh, I'm a Buddha, everything is over. They are hats in the dualistic Buddhism. They are constantly talking about how my job is done, have no more birth for me, you know, which you know leads people to the misunderstanding that Buddhism is somehow anti-life. What they really say, some of them may think that they're not going to be born again, but Buddha has another thing coming to them later, as he informs them in the Lotus Sutra and a few other places, that there's no way in which something will ever become nothing. Nirvana is not nothing. And Nirvana is also not a place. It's uncreated. It's not a place you create by a causal process. The causal process is stripping away your failure to understand where you actually are already. That's the non-dualism. But they say that. And then even people say, oh, well, Buddha, what do you mean? Buddha doesn't get reborn. But Buddha is totally reborn. Poor guy. Nirmanakaya, the body of emanation of a Buddha, they say, by definition. Now, I don't know if it's true. Could be mass delusion, but it's one I prefer to this mass delusion. But Nirmanakaya is because you are infinite, right? Just think about it, by definition. You have become infinite. And to you, that's a blissful thing. That's your Dharmakaya, reality body, and Sambhogakaya, your beatitude body. Okay? But being one with everything means you're also one with every painful thought of every living being, infinitely. Not just even on one planet, infinitely. You are totally aware of them not realizing. You have a double vision. You see them as uninterrupted part of the ocean of bliss. No problem. But you see them not knowing that and being really thinking they're unhappy, but therefore being unhappy. They're taking themselves as a bunch of bliss, configuration of bliss, and configuring it so as to feel misery. And you could always say, well, it's just their delusion, but they're still feeling it, and it still makes them miserable. So what is your oneness with them? How does it manifest? It manifests whatever medicine they need. Because you are one with the creative energy of the luminosity that makes everything. So you can't even resist being born, manifesting yourself in some specific way that fits with their specific configuration and distortion of confusion that makes them experience bliss as suffering, right? Which means ignorance, right? So Buddha's born infinitely, in other words, reborn infinitely. They just don't emphasize it because people who find birth to be laborious would be freaked at the endless seva of being a Buddha. You know, Buddha is a servant of every suffering being. They say Buddha, any one of you becoming one, or if you already have, considers every other sentient being the way it's specific, one by one, the way a mother considers her only beloved child. In other words, that life and that making that suffering into a happiness is more important than some sort of manifestation of oneself. You know, if you're having trouble with your child as a mother and you hear that, you might think, poor guy. Because, of course, you don't know that it's possible for Buddha because of the intensity of the bliss of the awareness of luminosity, the deathless state where you are the vastness of life. You know, Amitayus is one of the names of Buddha called, which means boundless or immeasurable life, infinite life. So the precious human form, the form, so then in realistic world, when we get a realistic worldview like that, there's no end to the flow of causation, there's no beginning to the flow of causation, but there is a level, though, where one can perceive it all as not happening, in the sense that what makes it miserable is where one thinks it's really like this, you know, where one thinks it's this bunch of absolute things, so that one's suffering is an absolute thing. So there's a somehow, and then this goes into the non-duality, always goes into the realm of where you can't quite completely explain it all perfectly. You can only give vectors. But still, it means that intensity of the bliss of this vastness and of having melted through into it, into this life energy, and because it itself is bliss energy, meaning, what does bliss mean? Bliss means completely satisfying, and therefore naturally wanting everything that's enfolded in it to be satisfaction, that's all. And anything that's resisting that then becomes something to kind of flow around. But of course, it's skillful also because it's conscious. And if you just sort of try to bomb things into bliss, what happens is that people, it's like hugging a paranoiac. They feel they're being assaulted and they become more rigidly defended. And they try to ward off this flow of energy. They don't embrace it. So the only way they can open is through their own understanding, opening that it's all right. You know? So then the realistic motivation, life motivation, is the second branch of the Eightfold Path. And that motivation, once you realize, if you realize that your life, body and mind are an evolutionary eye blink, a moment, in an infinite path, coming from an infinite past, going toward a potentially infinite future, and you're this moment, your life is a moment, not just that you're going to be in the moment of this life, but your whole life is. And that moment, what you do in that moment, can determine the quality of that infinite future, big time. You then become where there's no other sensible purpose to this life than opening to the luminosity by whatever method there is. That is really the highest priority it becomes, right? And then, and you really get jacked up, that's why it's the first in the path, because then you're motivated to really use your life in a sensible way. And that's why those people who met Buddha in ancient time, they would just come into his field, they would just see him, and they would say, okay, I'm with you. And he would say, ehi bhikkhu, which bhikkhu, by the way, doesn't mean monk, it means mendicant. So it's only possible in a society where there is a free lunch, unlike ours. Because mendicant means one who lives on alms food, you know, and asks for free lunch. Not breakfast, not dinner, just lunch. So he says, ehi bhikkhu, you know, come here, mendicant, and then they change their clothes, they're recruited immediately. Because they somehow feel, they see the possibility of being this kind of entering this field of bliss and becoming a node of bliss for all beings. They see that, you know. Even though they might interpret it as it means they sort of have to send their mind elsewhere to some nirvana. And they don't see it, they don't see the immediate possibility of that. Which is complicated because you have to unravel something surgically, very carefully. You can't just smash through it. Right? And then the second thing, once you realize how precious that is, then you meditate on death with what are said to be the three roots of the meditation on death, which is, the first one is overcoming the denial that you will die. And here the Buddhists would say that, well, everyone intellectually knows that they will die. When you meditate on the certainty that I will die, if you go deeper, you realize that it's sort of on some level, more subliminal level, you act like you'll always be there, the way that, you know, the way you are. You'll always be your one unchanging point of personality. It will always be you. And so we act like we're always having endless tomorrows. You know, we put off things, we procrastinate, we think we'll go to the on retreat later, you know, whatever, after we finish this, after we make our million, then we'll go off and meditate and become enlightened, sort of thing. Now, in Silicon Valley, there it's a billion, I think. Million isn't more, much now. So that's the first route. And then you get really certain that you will die, and you suddenly realize, therefore, every minute is really precious. Then the second route is said to be the uncertainty when it will be, could be your last any time. Then that gets you even more pumped up and intensified. And then the third route is that when you do, only your super subtle mind, your spiritual gene, will be what you take with you. So what are you invested in your openness, your super subtle mind? And a synonym for that could be openness to luminosity. What are you investing in your openness to luminosity? And the way you invest, how do you invest in your openness to luminosity? How do you open yourself? Well, you give gifts. You let go of something you really like that you think you should keep. You let go of it. That opens you. That act. You mentally let go of some credible attachment. That opens you. You know, then you think of someone else's situation. When you interact with someone, you think of how it's impacting them. You're ethical. You're ethical, and you want them to get something from it. And you see it from their point of view, what it is that they want, and you act accordingly, you know, then that's being ethical. And that opens you, because you restrain maybe what you just only think about what you want. And then someone hurts you, and then instead of reacting angrily, you use that to build your tolerance. And you realize that they did so because of their confusion, because they were gripped by some negative emotion that has them working like a robot, you know, and they don't know what they're doing, and they're going to be more hurt in the future than you are, etc. So you develop what they call the shield of patience or tolerance, and then you become creative about opening yourself and doing more and being more and thinking more, and then you get into meditating and you get into critical thinking, you know, wisdom. So you do those paramitas, you know, those transcendent practices and virtues. And then you become a more enlightened being. You use this human life really fantastically. It becomes the platform of infinite positive progression. If you don't attain Buddhahood in this life right away, you will at some life, absolutely. The other thing about it is, remember when Buddha attained enlightenment under the Bodhi tree, he had a big shock before attaining Nirvana. Well, in a way, I think he was so close to Nirvana, it didn't shock him that much. But if you remember the story in whatever version you heard, all of the versions agree that he first remembered infinite previous lives of himself. Beginningless previous lives, he remembered in every detail. So the mind's expanse into infinitude is also in time as well as space. And that was first thing. And I believe he could do that then because he was at the bliss boundary of Nirvana. And so he realized he'd always been in Nirvana in all those previous lives. Even though some of them had been hell, some of them had been here. But he realized, because he realized Nirvana was uncreated and has always been here. So he shifted the context. It's a Nirvanic context. Of, you know, he was at that point of final veil of ignorance being drained, and he was even seeing the past as having been Nirvana. He was revising his memory, his experience of those past things. He was revising that as having, oh, I was actually in Nirvana then when I was roasting on a fire, or when I gave my, remember he gave his body as a rabbit to a traveler, and jumped in the fire to be cooked as rabbit burgers. Remember? But then he wasn't any more painful to him when he was at that phase. He just saw that as a part of the play of bliss. And then, second, he remembered everybody else's previous life. And, you know, you can't say, therefore, that your beloved Theravada, where's my Theravada fanatic over there? You can't say that your beloved Theravada doesn't teach compassion, because if you had infinite previous lives and you remember them in detail, and everyone else did too and you remember them in detail, then you are completely confronted with your total entanglement with every single being, beginningless entanglement, that it's all one being. And you've been in every conceivable relationship with every single one. And so your feelings are their feelings, and vice versa. You know, is that, but without mentioning the word compassion, I just say he remembered everybody else's previous lives. Then he saw all their future potential destinies. And so he had to unfold their futures as well, you know. And then he attained the termination of all outflows, as they say, or contaminations, which is nirvana. But then the great thing about Buddha, which I really like, well, I like a lot of things about him, but one of them was at that point he smiled. You could attain knowledge, full knowledge and experiential knowledge of reality, and you could go, oh no, what a bummer, how awful. And then I better not tell anybody about it, I freaked them out. They could say, ignorance is bliss in this case, right? But he didn't say that. He said, ignorance is suffering. Actually, if you know what's going on, you'll be blissful. He smiled, in other words. That was a great thing. That's one thing I like about him. Then the second thing, he said, okay, now I'm a Buddha, I know everything, and I'm happy. But I don't say you have to believe that. He then said, I'm not demanding this kind of blind faith belief. He says he's a Buddha, and he's kind of cute looking now. They all did think he was cute. He was like golden rays, he had big earlobes, an extra scoop on his head. He was very great looking. But he said, someone else will come up and be cuter and tell you a bunch of baloney. So you shouldn't believe what people tell you just because you think there is something. You should, what I'm asking you to do only is try this out yourself. Be realistic about your worldview. Be motivated to use your life according to whatever you think is reality, etc. Cultivate, calm your mind. Be ethical, meditate, and learn the nature of reality. Because I'm confident that you can understand it. And that's all I'm saying. Try it. If it doesn't work, forget about it. If it works, if you start feeling better, if you start becoming more confident about what I've told you, then you start giving me some credibility. But that's all I ask, he said. Use your intelligence, yourself. You know? And particularly, they say, if you think that my analysis of emptiness and of the two realities, relative and absolute, and that there can't be an absolute in the relative, and therefore your sense of your own absoluteness or the object's absoluteness is the key root distortion that you have, and if you find that to be true and you really come more into your relatedness with the world in a better way, then you can give me credibility about things that I tell you that you can't immediately verify, such as future life and things like that. But the key thing is, what is your own nature? You look at it. And if you find that the path of analyzing yourself and discovering that all those things you thought were solid dissolve under analysis, and if my method there proves helpful to you, my wisdom method there proves helpful to you, then I deserve some credibility. That's how he did it. He didn't just demand that he was an authority, you know, at all. So I think that's really good. That's like a good teacher is like that. They learn as they teach. Even they're teaching the same thing 100 times, they learn something new when they're doing it. Once you get a context where you begin to think that you could understand anything new, you have unlimited potential, you will manage to confront these things, you can open to the thing. In other words, once you get out of feeling that you can't, you know, then the map is what the Tibetan Book of the Dead provides. And then it does so on the claim of a scientific report, actually, accumulated by many people who experienced this and who did so lucidly and then made the description. It's a tradition in Buddhism called Abhidharma. Dharma can mean teaching or reality. Abhidharma means organized teaching, something like that. you know, super teaching and sort of scientific teaching. And the thing is that when you die, you know, there are these eight, you don't know about the eight states of melting and so forth. You know about those?
I heard you on your podcast.
Yeah. Oh, you heard that on a podcast. Yeah. Well, there, you know, it's like your body goes to sleep. You know, you can't, your motor last to go is the motor thing. You can't move. Your ability to recognize things gets lost. You have a kind of hallucinatory thing. You then see kind of light flashing, feel like you're in clouds or in smoke. And then eventually you come to this luminous space. And then, unfortunately, the luminous space can be spoiled for you if you haven't trained yourself, instead of watching Miss Piggy or even Avatar, if you have not trained yourself to let go into luminosity, where you can sort of let go of feeling, like right now, if I sit, right, you know, then the body is here, you know, and then I have a concept of being in my body. You aren't actually naturally in your body. You have a concept of being in your body. Your brain has a model of your body that it then thinks you're sitting in a certain way. And then you if you develop concentration, you get where you don't necessarily identify yourself as just being your body. You can go into a visionary field. You can go into those higher contemplative states where you are just kind of fields of emotion, positive, like infinite love, infinite, you know, the four dhyanas. You can do that kind of thing, and all those things are good, because especially if you're armed with common sense knowledge that any state you might enter that might be some sort of vastness or something is not. It's once you enter it, it's not a. It's a relative state. It's not an absolute state, so you won't be stuck or you won't transfer your attachment too much to that state. And but the more you get used to letting go, you know, then the better you'll be at that time of coming into the moonlight, sunlight, dark light, and then the most subtle one, the transparency, which is kind of the map. And the more and then there are these 80 instincts. You can learn what they are, and some of them are like where your mind becomes like a little Pac-Man that wants to eat things, you know, and wants to like grab onto things. Because, you know, we're used to, like in a dream, when you're in a dream, you also are a separated embodiment in the dream in an environment, and you're reacting to things that happen to you and trying to control it and not have bad things happen, run away from them if they're bad, embrace them if they're good. And you're reproducing what you're used to, which is being sort of a motorized entity, that an awareness that reacts to things around it that are not it. So that's what one's comfort zone sort of is when it's going well. And when it doesn't, then one just wants to get back to where it is. And if you let those unconscious drives will interfere with the feeling of the spacious whiteness and redness and orangeness and darkness, and then completely at the rest place, which is the transparency, where the self-other thing completely dissolves. These instincts will drive one, and one will shoot past that clear thing, and then one will gravitate toward what one is used to again. But in a way, that's not bad. I do think, personally, that the Buddhists exaggerate the danger of the sort of limbic brain, which in neuroscience called the limbic brain thing, but in the Buddhist case, it would be the fact that we can identify with animal forms, and where we would then gravitate, like someone who was a B-52 pilot and really into their plane, they might be interested in the form of a dragonfly. Or, you know, someone who was a tank person, never mind a Volkswagen owner, Beetle, you know, they might think that's a good body. I want a body like that. And they would gravitate towards beetle-like or rhinoceros things if they were tank drivers. You know, they might think a rhinoceros was a good thing. Why have to go get one and like go to the motor pool and put gas in it? Just be one, you know. I think a lot of our tools, human tools, are modeled on animal forms. And therefore, there's a danger of someone to identify that one might go toward that. So, you know, in a warrior bristling with swords and armor and live by killing samurai, you know, they might feel like some kind of tiger or lion. You know, they wear them in their battles, right? Those helmets, you know. They have like fierce animal fangs on their helmets, things like that. Horns, you know. So it's a matter of cultivating identification. There is and the key there is, if one has practiced releasing all identifications, You know, no identity, no knows, no attainment, no non-attainment. One practices that a lot. Then the more one, deeper one practices that, the more conscious one becomes of the unconscious, the more one can shape the negative things, and fears and aggressions and lusts and dissatisfactions and angers and things, and diminish their power and increase the power of positive things and creativity and free artistry, let's say, imaginative artistry. And then one can sort of gravitate toward more and more beautiful forms. For example, they do say that beauty in the human life comes from having cultivated patience in former life. And ugliness comes from being aggressive and predatory. And predatory animals do have a kind of, you know, we say tiger, tiger, burning bright, but when one is eating us, we're not really thinking how beautiful it is. unless we're Buddha, actually, in his previous life as a bodhisattva, where he gave himself to a tigress to prevent her eating her cubs. So those are the programs. Those are the things. And what the Tibetans have brought in the West lately, which is they themselves would not consider that they created this. They are preserving the great ancient culture of India, which was the great mother culture of Eurasia, actually, in this latest history, for sure. It was the California of Eurasia in the ancient time, and was just way ahead of everybody. And they developed extraordinary methodologies of going into the unconscious and redesigning and creating archetypes, you know, whole mandala thing and all of that. But that's all on the basis of this no eye, no ear, no nose, in other words. You don't have the power of imagination to make those creative, to successfully do that creativity unless you have sort of freed your imagination completely from being imprisoned in all routinized conceptualities, which is what you melt those by voidness, emptiness. Emptiness is the mother of that freedom. You know, contemplate. It's the medicine of that freedom. But not if emptiness is thought of as the absolute. Emptiness of emptiness. It's itself empty. In other words, emptiness is. So that's the program. The details of that I cover very much in my introduction to the book of my version of the Book of the Dead. There are some much more heavy tomes that have been translated here and there about this kind of thing. Tantra is like that. That same Lama who was worried about Miss Piggy, he once answered somebody. Somebody said, "Oh, Rinpoche, what is Tantra?" You know, he passed away that one, but he was particularly nice. And he said, and I'd never heard anyone say that before then, he said, "Well, you know, the job of wisdom and of the Prajnaparamita is to destroy the world of suffering, to really destroy it, to just eliminate it and melt into the luminosity. But once having done that, the luminosity is not, you know, just somewhere outside of the world. It is the nature, inner nature of the world. And then there are those who are not enjoying it. You immediately become aware when you merge with it. And so then rebuilding a world based on wisdom is then the job of Tantra, the methodology of rebuilding the world for the benefit of, to embrace, to enfold with maximum effectiveness those who are suffering and provide the medicine for them. That's what its job is. So there's no final... Emptiness does not destroy the world. It destroys the ignorance. And then the world is there to be shaped. And what you do when you realize emptiness is you take responsibility for reshaping it to whatever degree you can. And the highest ability to reshape is what a Buddha has, because you're sort of present everywhere in it. You're sort of merged with your material, something like that. Okay? So that's kind of what we want to do. And then the Bodhisattva, if the Bodhisattva gets the imagination, if something triggers in a bodhisattva's imagination that, oh, one could be like that, it makes sense. Given infinite opportunity, given infinite past, that beings have already become like that and left methodologies of how to do it. Given the fact that might as well try something stuck here infinitely and it's boring to be infinitely suffering, then I want to be that. So then that becomes the bodhisattva vow. You know, one then becomes decides, I'm going to be a bodhisattva. I'm going to live for the bliss of all beings. And that's a motivation that makes the same meditation you could do where you're just trying to attain your own nirvana. The same thing becomes a bodhisattva practice when your motivation is you are doing that in the acknowledgement, although you don't yet viscerally experience it, of your complete connectedness to everybody else. So you're doing it in everyone else as well as in yourself. That's the bodhisattva thing. And they say that's like a glorious sunrise. That's like, that's a Buddhist version of being born again. Something like that. Because it's like turning your heart inside out. You're going to really focus, you're going to be altruist. Because then that's the only hope in an infinite setting. Right? There's two ways of being in an infinite entanglement with infinite numbers of beings. Everyone can be just for themselves and battling it out with everyone else endlessly is hell, right? Or everyone can be in love with everybody else, only wanting everybody else to be happy. And if the price of that is, well, in one way, you're included in everyone yourself. So, you know, but mainly in outlook, forget about yourself. Let them all be happy. If each one is doing that, then you get, instead of one person worrying about yourself, you have everybody else worrying about you. That's called a Buddha land. Sometimes I equate a Buddha land with John Belushi food fight universe. Because in the selfish land, I got my dessert over here, my shumuso chocolat, you know, don't look at it, you know. I've got mine, you know. I don't want to share it over at Buddhist retreat. Well, maybe I should, but no, I want it. That's one. And then food fight universe is, oh, everyone here to have some dessert. And then you give away your dessert and then you get mushed with everybody else's thing. And then you throw it back. You know, so it's a food fight. It's a dessert fight. Very, very unhealthy when you get sugar into it. We'd all be diabetic. But that's possible. In other words, one has to first imagine that that's possible. And in the whole terrible thing, like I've been in many Zen centers, and they go like, beings are numberless, I vow to save them all. Then you say, are you going to have a future life? Oh, no, I'm a modern scientific person. I read The Inquiring Mind. I love Westminster, you know. Not me, no way. That's an old-fashioned thing, some old-fashioned, I don't know. Even maybe Steve Batchelor says maybe Buddha didn't even believe it in himself. Give me a break. Like, how can anybody be Buddha without infinite evolutionary canvas on which to draw create a Buddha world, a Buddha verse, as I call it, Buddha land? How is that possible in one life? No way. You know? So that's why the first step is to meditate on the precious jewel of a human life endowed with liberty and opportunity. To realize how great each one of us is.
This podcast was made possible through the generous support of the Tibet House U.S. membership and listeners like you. If you're inspired by what you hear in these weekly podcasts, be sure to like and share on your favorite social media platform. And when in New York City, be sure to visit Tibet House U.S. And when in upstate New York, visit its retreat center, Menla Mountain, located in Phoenicia, New York. Podcast music provided weekly by Tenzin Chogyal. All rights reserved.